Imagine a king invites you to his son's wedding, right? And you decline. So he sends his army to burn your entire city to the ground.
Wow.
Yeah. And then he just drags random strangers off the street to eat the catered food, only to like violently throw one of those strangers out into the dark just for wearing the wrong clothes.
I mean, it sounds like the plot of a dystopian fantasy novel or, you know, an overreaction by a deeply unstable tyrant.
It really does,
yeah.
But it's not. It is actually one of the most famous stories told by Jesus, the parable of the wedding banquet, found in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke.
Right.
And to modern 21st century ears, this story sounds entirely unhinged. The cause and effect are totally broken. But that is exactly the mission for our deep dive today. We are asking a crucial question for you, the listener. As a Christian, what hidden meanings are we missing when we explore an English translation of an ancient culture?
Yeah, we miss almost everything, to be honest, if we don't understand the lens through which these stories were originally told.
Exactly. We want to find what are the common threads across time that we can focus on to become closer to Christ. And to do that, well, we have to strip away our modern assumptions. We need to step out of our comfortable, you know, individualistic worldview and step into the brutal, highly structured reality of the first century Mediterranean.
And the absolute bedrock of that reality is something anthropologists call an honor and shame culture.
Right. Honor and shame.
Yeah. Because in the modern West, if someone insults us, our feelings are hurt. Maybe our reputation takes a temporary hit. But in the ancient Middle East, honor was a tangible currency.
Like it had actual value.
Exactly. It was your lifeblood. Losing honor meant social death, economic ruin, and basically exile from your community. So what looks chaotic or disproportionate in our English Bibles is actually a deeply cohesive, challenging theological message once you understand the social rules governing honor.
Let's put some flesh on those bones.
Yeah.
Because the whole inciting incident of this parable, the thing that kicks off all the violence, is a dinner party invitation. And I look at this and think, okay, if I RSVP to a Facebook event and then I just don't show up, or I text at the last minute saying I'm tired, I mean, sure, it's rude. I'm flaking.
Yeah, a bit of a faux pas.
Right. But I don't expect the host to declare martial law over it.
Well, that modern comparison is exactly where the text gets flattened out. To understand the king's reaction, you have to consider the sheer, terrifying logistics of throwing a massive royal banquet in an era without modern technology.
Oh, right. Like they didn't have refrigerators.
Exactly. Zero refrigeration. That was the absolute biggest hurdle.
Which means if you are serving meat to hundreds or, I don't know, thousands of people, you are on an incredibly strict, immediate ticking clock. You can't prep the main courses a week in advance and just stick them in a walk-in freezer.
No, not at all. The animals, the fatted calves, the oxen, they had to be slaughtered, butchered, roasted, and served on the exact same day.
That sounds like a nightmare.
It was. Think about the unpredictability of that process. Depending on the slaughtering, the building of massive fire pits, the cooking time, you just couldn't put a precise timestamp on the invitation.
Right.
Because of that logistical nightmare, a double invitation was standard cultural practice for the elite.
So the first invitation is essentially like a save the date. You are committing to being available whenever the fires are lit.
And that is the hinge of the entire conflict right there. The guests in the parable accepted that first invitation. They gave their word.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah. So the second invitation wasn't a question of, hey, are you still coming? It was the final announcement. The food is ready. Come right now.
Okay. That completely shifts the psychological weight of the rejection.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't someone declining an initial invitation because they're busy.
No.
This is someone looking at a king who has just expended a massive amount of wealth, whose servants have literally just slaughtered a herd of expensive animals that are rapidly spoiling in the sun, and saying, actually, no, we don't care.
It is a calculated, devastating public humiliation. By rejecting the second invitation, you are intentionally shaming the host in front of the entire region. You are saying his feast, his son, and his honor mean absolutely nothing to you.
And because the host isn't just a wealthy neighbor, but a monarch, well, the math goes from a social insult to outright treason. You don't publicly humiliate a king in the ancient world unless you are actively challenging his right to rule.
You've hit the nail on the head. It's a declaration of political rebellion.
And the guests don't just stay home either. Matthew's account adds a detail that turns the dial up to 11. they murder the messengers.
Yeah, that part is wild.
Right. The king sends people to say the banquet is ready, and the guests literally kill them in the streets. I mean, that elevates this from a ruined dinner party to a violent insurrection.
Which is why the king sending his army to burn their city is not an overreaction. It is the standard, expected military response to an act of war in the ancient Near East.
It makes so much more sense now. Our modern English translations tend to smooth over all these rough, violent edges. The text sounds polite, but the theological depth that Matthew intended is hiding right there in the original Koine Greek. I really want to look closely at those hidden nuances.
We definitely should. The Greek text operates almost like a legal document here, proving the guest's guilt. Let's examine the phrase translated in English as those who were invited. The Greek word used is kyklaimenes.
Okay. And I'm assuming that carries a lot more weight than just, you know, people on a guest list.
Oh, absolutely. It carries the weight of a binding contract. Grammatically, a kalklemis is a perfect passive participle.
A perfect passive participle. What does that mean in practice?
Well, in ancient Greek, the perfect tense isn't just about something that happened in the past. It describes an action completed in the past that has ongoing binding effects in the present.
Wait, so the grammar itself permanently stamps these guests as people who had already entered into a covenant.
Exactly.
Their past, yes, was legally binding on their present reality. They were actively breaking a vow.
Furthermore, consider the messengers they murdered. The English translation usually calls them servants, but the Greek word is doloi,
which translates to slaves or bondservants, right? Not freelance event planners or hired caterers.
Right. These were individuals bound entirely to the king's household. In ancient law, an emissary or a bondservant was considered a literal extension of the master's physical presence.
So striking the doulos is to strike the king himself.
Yes. And theologically, for a Jewish audience, these douloi clearly represent the Hebrew prophets. The prophets were bound to God, sent to announce that God's promises were ready, and they were notoriously beaten and killed by the people they were sent to.
Wow. So striking the prophets is striking God. The layers here are incredible. What about the event itself? A wedding banquet. Is there something we are missing in the translation there?
Actually, yes. The Greek word for the wedding banquet is gamoi. Notice the plural form.
Plural, like multiple banquets happening at once.
Sort of. Royal weddings in the first century were not a three-hour reception with a DJ. They were multi-day, sometimes week-long, lavish festivals.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the plural gamoi amplifies the staggering scale of the king's gift. He wasn't just offering a free meal. He was offering a sustained period of royal abundance, joy, and protection. Rejecting that is rejecting a massive, sustained outpouring of grace.
You know, there is one detail in the Greek notes that genuinely stopped me in my tracks. When introducing the king, the English text just says the kingdom of heaven is like a king. But the Greek specifically says Antipas Basileus, which translates literally to a human king.
Right.
My immediate thought was, if this king is obviously a metaphor for God the Father, why does the text go out of its way to specify a human king? It feels like it's dragging a divine metaphor down into the dirt.
Well, it drags it into the dirt on purpose. By using the phrase a human king, the text subtly grounds the story in the harsh political realities of the first century Mediterranean.
I see.
Jesus's original audience lived under the brutal thumb of the Roman Empire and the Herodian dynasty. They knew exactly how actual human kings reacted to treason.
Yeah, Rome didn't send strongly worded letters. They sent legions.
And they burned cities. By explicitly calling him a human king, the parable borrows the most terrifying political reality of its day to illustrate the absolute severity of rejecting God's covenant.
That sets up the allegory perfectly. A first century Jewish listener wouldn't just hear a moral fable. They would hear a sweeping, terrifying summary of salvation history unfolding in real time. Let's map this out for the listener. The first guests, the ones who made the covenant, accepted the save the date, but violently backed out when the feast was actually ready.
Right. They represent the religious elite of Israel. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the temple authorities, they had accepted the first invitation through the covenant of the Old Testament. They claimed to be eagerly awaiting the Messiah.
But when the Messiah actually arrived, standing right in front of them saying, you know, the feast is ready, they refused to go in.
Exactly. They not only refused, they killed the messengers. The Old Testament prophets and soon the early Christian martyrs who were beaten and executed for delivering the news that the kingdom had arrived.
Which brings us back to the burning of the city. Matthew 22, verse 7 says the king was enraged, sent his army, destroyed those murderers, and burned their city. For a modern reader, that's just the end of the insurrection plotline. But for an early Christian reading Matthew's gospel in the first century, that was a fresh, bleeding historical trauma.
Yes. Most historical scholars agree that this detail is a direct retrospective reference to the events of 70 AD.
The destruction of Jerusalem.
Right. The Roman siege of Jerusalem and the absolute leveling of the Second Temple. Early Christians, many of whom were Jewish, interpreted that unimaginable historical devastation as the tragic consequence of the religious elite rejecting the Messiah. The city literally burned.
The scale of this metaphor is breathtaking. I mean, it spans centuries of covenants, the blood of the prophets, the arrival of Christ, and the geopolitical destruction of Jerusalem. But out of the ashes of that burning city, the king does something that shatters the ancient world's social order. He tells his servants to go to the highways and the byways and gather everyone they can find, both good and bad.
And this is the radical, explosive opening of the gospel. In an honor and shame culture, you only invite people of equal or higher status to your table. Eating with someone below your station pollutes your own honor.
So by throwing the doors open to the literal street, the king is intentionally destroying the entire social hierarchy.
Absolutely. The highways and byways represent the Gentiles, the outcasts, the sick, the tax collectors, the sinners. The invitation is suddenly extended to the fringes of humanity.
Which is a beautiful picture of grace.
Yeah.
But it leads directly into the part of the story that has always frustrated me the most.
The guy with the clothes?
Yes. The absolute most confusing paradox in this entire parable. The king comes in to see all these new guests, and he spots a guy who isn't wearing the proper wedding clothes, the endomagamo, and he violently kicks him out.
It feels like a massive contradiction, doesn't it?
It feels totally unfair. I mean, if I am walking down a dirt road in the first century and royal guards suddenly drag me into a palace for a wedding, I am not going to be wearing a tuxedo. I'm going to be in my dusty, dirty work clothes. It's an impossible standard. How could the king possibly be angry at a street beggar for not wearing Armani? What are we missing here?
We are missing the ancient royal custom of the king's provision.
The king's provision? What is that?
Well, in the context of a first century royal wedding, if a king invited commoners or lower class citizens, he didn't expect them to own festal garments. That would be absurd. Instead, the king himself provided the wedding garments for every single guest at the door.
Wait, really? It was like a reverse coat check.
A reverse coat check is a fantastic way to picture it, yeah. As you enter the palace, the king's servants hand you a pristine royal garment to wear over your street clothes. And this served a profound social purpose. First, it maintained the honor and aesthetic of the royal wedding. But second, and more importantly, it instantly erased all class distinctions.
Oh, wow. Because once everyone puts on the exact same royal robe, you can't tell who was a wealthy merchant and who was a beggar from the byways.
Exactly. Everyone sits at the table equally clothed in the king's honor.
That completely flips the script on the guest crime.
The man was not cast out because he was poor or because he didn't have time to go home and change. He was cast out because he looked at the garment the king freely offered him at the door and he refused to put it on.
He wanted the food. He wanted the shelter. He wanted to sit at the table and enjoy the party. But he essentially said, I'm good in my own filthy clothes. It is the ultimate slap in the face to the host's grace. He is rejecting the very thing that makes him equal to everyone else in the room.
Throughout church history, theologians have been captivated by this singular moment. Early church fathers like Augustine, all the way up to 20th century thinkers, zero in on this wedding garment as the ultimate symbol of spiritual transformation.
I know the German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer had a very specific piercing phrase for this exact attitude.
Bonhoeffer called it cheap grace.
Cheap grace. Explain the mechanics of that, because Bonhoeffer was writing from a Nazi prison cell. He knew a thing or two about the cost of following Christ.
Well, cheap grace is the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance. It's the desire to enjoy the blessings, the comfort, and the safety of the kingdom of heaven without undergoing any actual life change. You want the crown without the cross.
Right.
The garment in this parable represents the righteousness of Christ. It represents the new life of baptism that a believer must actively put on. Free grace is the invitation from the street. Costly grace is putting on the garment, which requires you to cover up your old self.
It's like showing up to a hospital because you heard the cafeteria food is free, and you sit there eating while actively refusing to take the life-saving medicine the doctor is handing you. You are taking up space in the ward, but you are rejecting the healing that the building was designed for.
That analogy hits right at the heart of the parable's warning. The king's grace is radically inclusive. It brings in the good and the bad from the streets. But that grace is not permissive. It demands transformation. You cannot stand in the presence of the king and insist on remaining exactly as you were in the dirt.
And this is the profound common thread across time for you, the listener, in your own Christian walk. Receiving the invitation to the kingdom is only the beginning. The danger isn't just being one of the Pharisees who rejects the invitation outright.
No, not at all.
The more insidious danger is RSVPing, yes, showing up to the church, sitting at the table, and demanding to stay exactly as you are. We have to allow the king to clothe us in a new way of life. The grace is entirely free, but it demands everything you have.
It shifts the entire weight of the story. It moves from being a historical critique of the religious elite in the past to a stark, urgent, deeply personal warning for the newly invited Christians sitting in the pews in the present. You are invited, but you must be transformed.
So when we strip away our modern assumptions and look at the cultural mechanics, the parable of the wedding banquet isn't a story about an angry host overreacting. It is a brilliantly constructed, deeply layered exploration of honor, historical reality, and the profound cost of grace. But we have to address the consequence, because the story doesn't just end with the unprepared guest being asked to leave. We've talked about the feast, the provision, and the grace, but what actually happens to the man who refuses it? The English translation says the king binds him hand and foot and throws him into the outer darkness.
Which, to a modern reader, might just evoke an image of a guy shivering in the parking lot outside the banquet hall.
Right, just getting kicked out into the night air.
Yeah.
But knowing how heavy the Greek has been so far, I am assuming this isn't just a dark room.
No, it's not. The Greek word used for darkness here is skotos.
Skotos. What is the cultural weight of that word?
In ancient classical literature and first century thought, skotos wasn't merely the absence of physical light. This specific term was heavily associated with Tartarus.
Wait, like the lowest abyss of the underworld?
Exactly. The realm of the dead. A place of deep, profound existential punishment far removed from the realm of the living. When the king casts the man into the skotos, it implies a total, final, and absolute separation from the source of all light, joy, and life.
So this is not a dinner party faux pas. The stakes are eternal. We started this deep dive by talking about how this story initially looks like a muddy text that doesn't follow our comfortable script of cause and effect. But when you see the mechanisms clearly, the binding contract of the invitation, the treason of the murder, and the ultimate arrogant rejection of the king's provision, it makes perfect, terrifying sense.
The justice of the king is just as absolute as his grace.
It leaves us with a haunting reality to mull over as we go about our week. We rejoice that the doors were thrown open to the highways and byways. We rejoice that we are at the table. But we have to ask ourselves, what does it mean for us today if rejecting the king's transformation, even while sitting comfortably at his table, leaves us in skotos? Let that challenge drive you closer to the true cost of the cross. We'll see you on the next deep dive.